Happy Wednesday. Good to have you. 6:05. Good morning.
Oh, guess what day it is? Hump day.
It is hump day.
Boy, Jamie, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How about those Tigers yesterday, huh?
Dude.
I mean, look, we can get into the shutdowns and the extensions and the conversation. That was the bright point yesterday.
That was awesome yesterday.
It felt cathartic almost for them to win that game. Like, it was needed. Like, I was watching it, and it was, you know, you get towards the later end of the game, and they couldn't make good on some of the base runners that they had in the bottom of the, or the top of the eighth. And they were able to squeak out a win. They win it 2-1, and Tarek Skubal was... It was a masterclass.
I just saw bats flying, and nobody just... It was just like...
Swing.
Like, that's it. That's all I saw.
Skubal, 3 hits, 3 walks, 14 Ks, and he almost made it to the eighth inning. 7 2/3, 107 pitches. I'm like, is this guy going to throw a complete game?
Right.
And get this team on his back all the way across the finish line? It was unbelievable.
Well, I know one of the things that A.J. Hinch had talked about, like, in those in-game interviews with the sideline reporter, like, he said, like, hopefully he can go the distance. So they wanted him to go.
That's ideal.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it worked out. It really did. It worked out. And Skubal here post-game talking about how good it feels to beat the Indians.
Yeah, it means a lot. It means a lot to take
Guardians.
The ball game on. to have the trust of our whole organization. Teammates, coaches, you know, coaching staff, it means a lot. And it doesn't really matter how we got here. You know, we got in, everybody's in the same boat, and we're up 1-0 in a best of three. So it doesn't really matter how you get here, as long as you get in.
He was way more animated on the field than he was.
Yeah,
right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
But now I think it totally flips. Tigers can do it.
Oh, they can. I'm telling you, the Guardians were already, I thought, you know, had pressure on them. Now they really have it.
I almost had an aneurysm when Jose Ramirez hit that triple yesterday because it could have been avoided. I mean, Javi Baez made a great diving play at second base, threw it over to Torkelson, and Torkelson almost tried to, like, grab it out of the air, like, twitched his glove
right.
And just missed the ball. So went behind him, and Jose Ramirez got to third standing up. And I was like, oh, and it was no outs. He was the first batter
up.
And I'm like, oh, my, like, I'm seeing this story play out again.
Yeah.
But Will Vest and some terrible base running by Jose Ramirez took care of him, and they won the game. I was elated. And you're right, Jamie. You know, it does feel a little different today.
Of course it does.
From where I was
yesterday.
They're
going to win now.
Yeah. I love that. I wish I were there. But I feel more optimistic. Like, I'm like, yesterday I was 60-40, now I'm like 70-30. Like,
that's where I was yesterday.
Feeling a little better about it. Feeling a little better about it.
Yeah.
Casey Mize.
Come on, dude.
Come on,
you
man.
You can do it.
You can pull it through.
Casey Mize today on the bump at 1 o'clock. ESPN. Where will you be?
Watching.
Sitting in front of the TV watching that game.
Or at the cigar bar watching it with some of my buddies.
The government's shut down. The federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And we've avoided the state shutdown as well. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the federal government has officially closed for the 21st time. There is a spending gap in the last 48 years. Since 1977, we have now shut down for the 21st time. The last time was 2018, also during the first Trump administration. But lawmakers on the left were saying, look, there's just nothing in here for Democrats. There's nothing in here that we had proposed. There's nothing in here that we've talked about. And so they're holding out. They're standing firm. I was reading a story yesterday that House Democrats had a closed door meeting and reporters were outside and they could hear cheering. So there is a bit of a galvanization on the left on what they're doing to try to continue to fund the government with a continuing resolution.
I mean, I woke up feeling this is silly. It is so dumb to do this to IRS workers, TSA agents, you know, people that have to pay for daycare and mortgages and stuff. When why can't you just negotiate and figure it out? The Democrats will say the first time Hakeem Jeffries and Schumer were in the White House was Monday.
Yeah.
When
right.
He's been in the office since January. Why can't negotiations happen?
Well, I don't know that what they talked about even in the last week mattered, really.
No.
Like, I don't know that it was going to be anything.
Well, you know, they want those subsidies to, you know, not expire, and they want to continue with those. They don't expire to the end of the year, but they wanted that, you know, as part of this. And they're not willing to. They said, listen, come back to us when that happens, you know, when it gets closer to that. And they're like, we don't believe you're going to do that. We want it now in this budget. They wouldn't do
that. That almost seems more like legislative action.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you want to keep anything
it is legislative
in that way, like,
but that's what they want.
Go through the legislative action.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of what.
But they don't trust. That nobody's trusting anybody. Right
and
now,
I
man.
Think that's
trust.
Fair.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got Senator Thune saying, like, let's just pass this and then we can talk.
Yeah.
I understand the skepticism behind that, because how often does that result in any meaningful
exactly.
A, discussions or B, action?
Right.
But now they're shut down, and yeah, there's an impact. What that means to you, what that means to us. I mean, certainly you may encounter, if you do any sort of if you have any sort of business with the federal government, if you got to call the IRS, if you got to call whatever, you may see.
I was thinking during the morning we should call the Social Security office, see if we get anyone
see
on
if
the phone.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Those are the real impacts to people.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. All the other stuff is intangible. We don't really know. We don't really necessarily care. But, I mean, there's going to be parks, national parks that aren't going to be open because they don't have staff to staff it.
And will it start hitting the airports because TSA agents and stuff? I mean, they don't get
longer wait times.
But and also the air traffic controllers, you know, they won't get paid either. They have, you know, they show up. But some of them in the past. Because they were not getting
calling
paid.
Calling sick and
they
sick.
Didn't
yeah.
show up, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, you know, that could cause some delays at airports.
Meanwhile, Michigan lawmakers approved a bill to fund the state government for an additional week while they just work through the logistics of this bill that everybody's agreed to, or at mm-hmm. least both parties have agreed to. And they're trying to pass this annual budget. The deadline was also midnight mm-hmm. last night.
Mm-hmm.
And they signed this extension. You're talking about this one-week measure will amount to about $1.5 billion in spending. So it just keeps everything going until the 8th.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep things moving along, and then they're going to pass this bill, and Michigan should avoid all of the stuff at the federal level.
So they're telling you there's, you know, we got a deal. It's light at the end of the tunnel. It's not a train.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what it seems to be.
Right.
Yeah, that's
remember
what it
remember when
seems
they
to be.
Said they'd get it done by July?
Yeah, those were the days, huh?
They imposed that on themselves.
Uh-huh.
Don't have it by October 1st either.
Well, then I think it was Caitlin Buss over at the Detroit News or maybe Nolan Finley. I don't remember. But Somebody wrote an op-ed. They're like, you know, dock the pay.
Yeah.
If you can't pass a timely budget,
well, that's yeah.
then dock their pay.
That's what Mike Duggan says he wants to do, you know, if he becomes mayor, that, you know, if you don't get the budget done at the right time, then nobody gets paid.
I got no problem with it. I love it. Do your job.
I'm good with it.
Yeah. So that's the latest on all of our government shutdown news. Unfortunately, there's a lot of it.
So
we'll continue to follow that story for you and talk about it throughout the show today. Meanwhile, a strange meandering conversation to head military brass. How did that go yesterday? We'll talk to Austin Gullett on the other side here on JR Morning.
From new beginnings to milestone celebrations, Reliable Energy keeps your life and business on track. That's where Consumers Energy comes in. With 8,000 people plus countless ways to save, they've got your energy needs covered. From recycling inefficient appliances to helping you find energy-saving upgrades, count on Consumers Energy for rebates to help you use less. Because when you use less, you spend less, and that leaves room for more. More playing, more sharing, more making. Get started at consumersenergy.com/cleanenergy.
It's tiring to look out at combat formations, or really any formation, and see fat troops. Likewise, it's completely unacceptable to see fat generals and admirals in the halls of the Pentagon and leading commands around the country and the world. It's a bad look. It is bad, and it's not who we are.
That is Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth yesterday, addressing some of our highest-ranking generals and admirals in our U.S. military at Quantico. In what he, in a nutshell, was kind of the reorganizing of the military, meaning that higher standards for training, making sure that they are bringing people in and elevating people for merit and not for what he would consider to be woke reasons. And so this drew a lot of criticism. The president came out and kind of, you know, played a little bit of the greatest hits while talking about the military and how robust the military is and how far along the United States is in their military efforts as opposed to other adversaries around the world. Austin Gullett's a retired lieutenant commander, former U.S. Navy intelligence officer, and joins us this morning. Austin, it's good to have you. I'd love to know what you thought of what was said yesterday, and what do you think the feeling was inside that room in Quantico?
Yeah, good morning. Good to be with you. It's going to be a fun topic here. It's funny that quote that you played. I'm sorry, I'm a little under the weather, but the quote that you played, I'm on a text thread with some buddies, and they literally sent that exact quote, and they were, kind of laughing, but also kind of fired up about it, and agreed. Like, we shouldn't have, I don't know if I would have used the word fat, but
yeah,
it's true. You shouldn't have fat admirals and generals, at the top, as well as, fat troops, in the junior ranks. So, but no, I think overall, Secretary of War Hegseth gave an inspired speech and laid out his strategic vision. And I think that's always a good thing. Now, I think we can argue the merits of, should we have put all of that senior brass in one room? Was it worth the cost? I mean, DOD certainly has the funds. We spend a lot of money on a lot of things, but you can still argue the merits of it. I'm not saying you become frivolous with taxpayer money. And then the security aspect of it is also, a worthy conversation. I like the fact that they were on a military base, vice a hotel, convention space. Mm-hmm. So I think those two are fair points for discussion. But I did like Secretary Hegseth's message on, some takeaways that I put down were the lethality of the military, warrior ethos, restoring that culture, offensive priorities, ending, wokeness and identity politics, merit-based promotions. And I thought it was kind of thoughtful about, hey, you can overcome some minor mistakes on your record. He emphasized clear standards and ethos, genderless PT test. And really, it was kind of a strategic back to basics. But there was one quote that I really liked and resonated with me, and this is something that you want when you're in the field, at the strategic, operational, or tactical level. As he said, we want risk takers and aggressive leaders and a culture that supports you. I really like that.
Austin, the president told military leaders that American cities could serve as training grounds for troops and National Guard units. How does that strike you as a veteran and as a citizen?
Yeah, I mean, I don't love the idea of troops in uniform becoming, policemen and women for cities. I think when there are extremist situations like natural disasters, or if there are significant unrest, then I think that's okay. And I do think there, are some cities that have had very lax governance that has let crime get out of control. So I think that's a worthy conversation. But on its face, I don't love military policing cities. But from a training aspect, we actually do a lot of training in a lot of U.S. cities. It's just a lot of it's under the radar. So it's not something that is completely, new in a sense.
Hi, Austin. I have a question for you about the female aspect of this. I was trying to figure out, what are the standards for male and female folks in the military? Here's what a former Marine and FA-18 fighter pilot female had to say about it online, and then I want you to respond to it.
So here's the truth. Since combat roles have been opened for qualified women, there have always been one standard for those jobs. Flying a fighter jet, for example, there was never a men's standard and a women's standard for flying. Never. There wasn't a men's standard or a woman's standard to be an artillery officer or an infantryman. There wasn't a men's standard or a woman's standard to be a tanker or to be on a submarine. There was always one standard. Always. It's a slap in the face and offensive to suggest otherwise.
So that's her point of view. You could hear her emotion in it. What do you say?
Yeah, no, I appreciate her thoughts. And I think there's she's correct in a lot of ways. I think you have to drill down in the specificity. So from just generic, you know, physical readiness tests, we call them, you know, PRT tests. There are two different standards for men and women. Again, this is just, you know, like in the Navy, running a mile and a half, doing push-ups, however many push-ups in 2 minutes, however many sit-ups in 2 minutes. There are two different sets of standards for men and women to pass those PRT tests. For your job to, you know, pass flight school or, you know, the various specialties that she listed, there is sort of one academic and overall standard, but there are different
physical, exactly.
Okay. And now I think for the combat roles, like, you know, Army SF and Rangers and SEALs and, you know, Marine Special Forces, I think there was some talk under the previous administration of, well, hey, these are pretty high standards. Do we, you know, consider having different standards where perhaps it's a little bit more doable for women to compete in those non-combat roles? So there's for those, that's much more of a discussion where there is one set PRT test and a lot of, I think what Pete Hegseth was saying, specifically for the combat roles, you shouldn't water down those tests. And I don't think they have been, but there was a little bit of perhaps momentum to do that.
We have 30 seconds left here, Austin. George Patton, back in World War II, addressed the Third Army and said, you know, we're going to use the guts of our enemies to grease the treads on our tanks. And have we gotten away from that type of mentality? And did this speech get us closer to kind of the roots of what the military was designed to do?
I think so. I think presidents and administrations, they can always influence the culture. You know, are we more operationally aggressive? Are we more politically correct? Are we more risk adverse? And that leadership from the top down is pervasive. So I think, you know, Secretary Hegseth wanted to lay that out in a very clear manner in front of the leaders that are then going to have to carry that message down to their troops when they go back to their commands.
Mm. Austin Gullett, always appreciate the insight. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Have a great week.
Yeah, we'll talk again soon. But it was an interesting address. And, you know, the president came out and shared a lot of the same things. Before he went into the room, he talked about, you know, if I don't like somebody, I'm going to fire him.
Right.
You know, again, just going into a meeting like that with some of your top military minds, you know, it's a striking tone, certainly. We'll take a break. More coming up next on JR Morning. So how about the Detroit Tigers? They win yesterday. You feel good?
Yeah.
Yay!
I think they win now.
I was 70-30 yesterday, so yeah. I'm really feeling good today.
Jason yesterday threw out a score, and you were so wrong.
It was just flipped around. He said 2-1, but he said 2-1.
I said 2-1. I said Scuba 14 strikeouts. I said that yesterday.
Yeah, I think it's exactly. I think it's exactly
my, what you my said. 30-70 is now 50-50.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
No, I think he goes, I could see, you know, Tigers losing 2-1.
Right. That's what.
So Jason was right on the money. Right on the money with the score. Mm-hmm. But are you feeling better about it? 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. I am feeling a little bit better about it. I am. And now you've got another game today, 1 o'clock, against the Guardians in Cleveland. So I think that's going to be good.
I think we'll do it. And I think the Guardians...
You think they get it done today?
I think they get it done today. And I think the Guardians, watching them yesterday after the game, they had the same look on their face that we did when we were trying to...
Oof!
They had that don't know kind of look.
A little bit of a dejected look.
Jaws a little tight look.
Okay. Well, then that would serve the Tigers very well. The state government has averted a shutdown for the moment.
Yep.
They passed this little bridge bill, about $1.5 billion to get them through the next week while they work through just getting the framework that they agreed to, right? The bill that they agreed to, getting it through the government.
Yeah.
So all the leaders got together, they talked, they agreed that this was the bill, they agreed that this was the deal, and then now they got to get it through. So they didn't get to that stage where the governor was able to put her signature on this by midnight last night, but they did pass a little bit of a stopgap, you know, their version of a CR.
Yeah.
And they're going to get this done here in the next week.
Beth LeBlanc, Craig Mauger, up until the wee hours of the morning reporting for the Detroit News. They say about 1:45 is when Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks believed that there was a deal here, but they still needed the votes to become law. And the agreement involves that 24% tax on wholesale marijuana and shifting all taxes paid on gasoline to roads. So it seems like they have an agreement, but the Senate adjourned about 1:35 and will return at 10 a.m. today.
And the important thing here that she also said was that the government's going to be open for people. So mm-hmm. if you need something, it's going to be business as usual. There will be no hiccup. There's going to be no change in services.
Better late than never. At least they're working to get it done.
At least they're working. Yeah, for yeah. sure. For sure. Meanwhile, not so much at the federal level. The government shut down there. It's the 21st time since 77 that this has happened. I don't know how you don't get this done. And I understand that there are going to be some people out there that are on board with this, that are going to be fine with it, that feel like Democrats didn't do, didn't take the opportunity here and sign this continuing resolution and then talk on the back end. The politics are at play here, too. Everybody's pointing fingers.
Yeah, I mean, this is the same kind of deal where everything's the same. You just pass this and then you can continue to talk, kind of mm-hmm. like what the state just did.
Right.
But the Democrats are saying we're never going to have any sort of leverage to bring up our ideas for subsidies and health care and all that because we don't control the government. This mm-hmm. is the one time we have control. That would be their point of view.
And I think it's a good point of view. I think it's
the best that they could do at this point.
It is the best that they could do, and they got to roll the dice.
Yes.
And again, this is politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to be very careful, though, because at some point, you know, Republicans are going to dominate the airwaves and they're going to say, look, they're doing this. We have it. It's there. All they got to do is vote and sign it. All they have to do is vote and we'll get the president to sign it. That's it.
Yeah.
This doesn't have to happen. Democrats are doing this. They've been telling us that it's our fault that we've shut the government down for years. Mm-hmm. Well, now they're doing the same thing. And so if you're going to play the politics game, then you got to make sure that you've got everything shored up. And I have a hard time believing that the Democrats do. And most people aren't going to see an impact of this. Most people, some people certainly will, but most people won't. And then you're going to get to the situation where, everybody's going to be messaging and getting their perspective out. And how does that change things for how people look at this?
Well, yeah. And then these talking points that come out during all of this, I like to look into it. What does it mean? You know, this claim that the Democrats want illegal aliens to get health insurance.
Yeah, right.
Senator Warner was asked about that yesterday. And the reporter's question was like, this is the hill you're willing to die on, to that illegal aliens should get health insurance? And here's what he said.
One, the premise of your question is factually wrong. And I would urge you to actually look at the law, which prohibits any undocumented person from receiving any kind of health care benefits. That is the law. If the Trump administration is not enforcing the law, then I would ask the president.
So I'm like, okay, how did we get here? And I'm trying yesterday to figure this out because it's a talking point that's been Congressman Wahlberg talked about it yesterday. Basically, this is unauthorized immigrants are barred from federally funded health care programs. They can't buy health care plans on government exchanges by the Affordable Care Act. They can't receive subsidies. They're ineligible for Medicare, Medicaid, and children's health insurance programs. So how do we get to this talking point?
Yeah, you start that narrative and it just grows and grows, and that's what people believe.
Well, there are authorized immigrants. So folks who are here, you know, on work visas mm-hmm. and such that can get it. So perhaps that's how we got to this talking point, but it's certainly not illegal aliens getting it.
Well, again, but one of the points that Republicans are making here is that we're not putting things in, we're not taking things out. This is just furthering the money that we've already allocated
mm-hmm.
a few more weeks. This idea of continuing resolutions, I think, is a little ridiculous in and of itself from my perspective. Pass a balanced budget, right? Do that. Make sure that you're spending money in the right places. Do that. Stop kicking the can down the road. But they can't. They can't even do this.
No.
They can't even pass a simple continuing resolution, let alone find a way to balance their budget. It's impossible. So I don't know what we do from here, but the Democrats see an opportunity, they're going to take it. Republicans see an opportunity, they're going to run with it. And at the end of the day, when you shut the government down, there are people that are going to be impacted by that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the travesty here.
Oh, definitely people are going to be impacted, but, you know, on either side, who's the loudest? Who gets their point across the loudest?
Squeaky wheel gets the oil.
That's it.
I don't know. Shutting down the government, I don't think is a winning issue for anyone because it affects regular people. Maybe it's a message, but how long are they going to do this? The last one was in 2019 for 35 days.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time. Mm-hmm. It was a long time. And historically, they've been pretty short when the government has shut down. You know, it's been a couple hours, maybe a couple days. That one was particularly long. But, you know, you never waste a good opportunity here. And I think that's what both sides are saying. And like Jamie mentioned, you know, Democrats have no leverage at all. Zero.
Zero.
So they're going to take the opportunity to try to gain some of that leverage back. Will that work? I guess we'll see. What are they saying inside the halls of Capitol Hill? We'll talk to Ryan Schmelz, our Fox correspondent and WJR contributor, next here on JR Morning. Hey, also coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, have an opportunity for you to win $1,000. Maybe take a little fall getaway up north, a little fall golf.
Love that. Maybe a Somerset shopping spree.
That's a good call.
Hey, just maybe a little extra gas.
Well, a little extra gas. There you go. By the way, do you know what I did this morning? I went and got gas.
Okay.
I drove off with the pump still in the thing.
No.
I've never done that before.
Oh, jeez.
Everything was fine.
You're tired.
I've never done that before, though.
You didn't yank the...
No, it didn't even come out of the little thing.
Oh.
It just came out.
Good for you.
I was like, what was that
sound? Did you stop?
I did. I stopped. Okay. I turned around, went
good
back,
Samaritan.
Put it back in. I was mortified. but yes, take your $1,000, get some gas. All that you can do and more with this $1,000. We'll give you an opportunity to win that in the 7 o'clock hour.
Looking at this memo from Russell Vogt, Office of Management and Budget, he lays out what needs to happen. And it says, quote, it is unclear how long Democrats will maintain their untenable posture, making the duration of the shutdown difficult to predict. Regardless, employees should report to work for their next regularly scheduled tour of duty to undertake orderly shutdown activities. Our government is shut down. Ryan Schmelz is in the Capitol, Fox News correspondent and WJR contributor. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning.
So what now? I mean, how late into the night were people trying to make a deal, or was this sort of set as of the afternoon?
Well, they had a vote late in the evening, and then everyone went home for the most part. You had some people still lingering around, but you know, it's kind of, we accept the defeat at that point that we knew the government was going to shut down. I think everyone was kind of expecting it at that point. The interesting thing is that I think Republicans do see a possible path out of this before the end of the week, which is that they're going to keep voting on the same bill that they voted on yesterday. And they believe that there are 5 Democrats who might be willing to flip and then get them to the 60 votes needed to break the Senate filibuster. And if that's the case, then this thing is over with and the shutdown's going to end. But getting 5 might be a challenge. They got 3 yesterday, which was a, you know, pretty impressive haul, or at least I think a telling haul. And we'll see if that changes.
The GOP's proposal, it's a 7-week extension that takes us through like November 24th.
Yeah, 21st.
Yeah. Is that timeline genuinely long enough to negotiate a full budget deal, or is that, you know, the short duration itself a political
possibly
tactic?
Possibly. Okay. You know, because right. Well, I mean, like, we've seen Congress negotiate these things in a week.
Yeah.
Some cases, like, you know, just it depends on how the politics of it will reflect on GOP leaders, because right now they're negotiating 3 of them, 3 of the 12 spending bills that they need to pass. And then they'll probably negotiate the defense budget, and then, you know, that's a good portion of the federal government right there.
Mm-hmm.
But then you negotiate the rest, and they could either do that individually on spending bills, or they could do it all as one big omnibus bill. So I think it's definitely possible that could be enough time. It just depends on if that's going to be what Congress prioritizes its time on, and decides that all they're going to focus on between now and then is the budget bills, and, you know, then it surely is possible. you know, when if you spend time on things like the One Big Beautiful Bill Act or other stuff like that, then you're not going to be able to get it done.
I'm surprised that there's this thought out there that they're going to be able to flip some of these senators so quickly. Who are they targeting, and what's I guess what's the guarantees on the back end then?
Well, when's the next time Gary Peters is coming on your show?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when I'm watching. That's when I'd watch for. You know, I'd watch for the ones who are retiring. You know, Tina Smith, Minnesota. There's the two New Hampshire senators. You know, remember, one of them voted for the last bill when they did this in March, and those Democrats got a lot of flack for it. You know, there's a couple others you might want to watch for, maybe like John Ossoff, who's up for re-election. I just think that, you know, the fact that you had three yesterday, which some people didn't even think Democrats would bleed any votes yesterday. But, you know, you look at their statements, they're putting out memos saying that if you that the longer the shutdown goes on, the more that you're putting Russ Vogt and Donald Trump in charge of reopening the government and potentially having decision making over personnel. And, you know, there's concerns that federal workers will get fired permanently because the government is in a shutdown mode. So, and then replaced with somebody else. So I think there is that thought that if you let this thing linger on, it might not be worth it.
I'm seeing this push, especially from Representative Ralph Norman, saying, well, if federal workers aren't going to get paid during a shutdown, then lawmakers shouldn't
members
get paid
of Congress
either,
shouldn't get paid.
Which
I knew
makes
exactly
absolute complete sense to me. But this is a constitutional amendment. How would that get passed?
I mean, that's the problem. That's why it hasn't been passed yet. It's kind of like term limits or some of these other things. You know, if you were to go around and poll people about it, most people support term limits. Most people support members of Congress not getting paid during a government shutdown.
Yeah, but if there's a camera or microphone in front of them.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, if there's a constitutional amendment, though, I mean, those things are just very hard to pass. And, you know, I haven't seen any indication that Congress is prioritizing its time worrying about that or trying to pass something like that. I mean, it hasn't really been. Yeah, it's something it gets brought up. A bill like that gets brought up every time this happens. It usually ends up going nowhere.
Speaking with Ryan Smales, Fox correspondent, WJR contributor. And Ryan, why are the Republicans so absolutely unified in refusing to even include the ACA language in a short-term bill, even if it gets them the votes to reopen the government? I mean, what is it, a fear of setting a precedent, a dangerous precedent?
Couple things. Number one, the price tag on it is awfully hefty. Number two, there are thoughts amongst Republican circles that the program needs to be significantly reformed and that they feel there needs to be an extensive negotiation when it comes to what you do with extending the Affordable Care Act tax subsidies. You know, Lisa McClain said to me yesterday, we have the podcast out, that she thinks it is a program that needs to be talked about and does need to be in some way, shape, or form extended. But she also thinks that the program needs to be completely overhauled and reform significantly. And that's not something you can do in a, you know, a budget bill. So I think Republicans are saying that, well, we're interested in extending these Affordable Care Act tax subsidies, but, you know, we want to do it our way. We don't want to just do it your way and do a blanket extension of this. And especially when Democrats want to make it permanent, that's how they put the language in there. So that's just not something that's going to fly with Republicans. And they feel like that's just, that's something that needs to be completely separate from this. But here's also the problem, too. Democrats want to get that put in the bill, and Republicans have said, well, we'll give you assurances. But Democrats are like, well, we don't trust
you.
We
don't believe
you.
No,
we have zero power, so probably won't happen, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ryan Smales, Fox News correspondent, thanks for checking in with us. Day one of the government, federal government shutdown. Thank you.
Here we go. Thank
here
you.
We go. Buckle up.
That's right.
Coming up, Tigers clawed their way. That was a gritty Game 1 win. Tarek Skubal lights out. 14 Ks, franchise playoff record. Hear from him next on JR Morning.
All right, Tigers with a big win yesterday.
They did it.
I was thrilled because it didn't look like it was going to go down the way that it ended up going down.
No.
But they ended up getting the win 2-1. Tarek Skubal just pitched an absolute gem.
I mean, he was on fire.
He was on fire.
He was so amped up. When he was getting those guys to swing and miss, he was just always saying, let's go, as he's getting back in the dugout. And every time he came back out, I'm like, oh, my God, is he going to pitch a complete game here? He almost did.
He did.
7 2/3. He got the job done and a franchise playoff record of 14 Ks.
Unbelievable.
Yep. And here he is talking post game about getting his team to this point.
Yeah, it means a lot. It means a lot to take the ball game on, to have the trust of our whole organization, teammates, coaches, you know, coaching staff. It means a lot. And it doesn't really matter how we got here. You know, we got in, everybody's in the same boat, and we're up 1-0 in a best of three. So it doesn't really matter how you get here, as long as you get in.
Look, his emotional roller coaster, he already expended all his emotions on the field. That was a little subdued.
Yeah. Little subdued.
But either way, I think the Tigers won the series now, and I'm pretty confident.
I think it's happening today.
They scored the go-ahead run in the seventh inning. Zach McKintry safety squeeze to Riley Green. That is not something you see very often.
Whatever. Small ball?
I love a little small ball. If that's what gets it done, you get it done.
Get the W, man.
Yep, get the dub and move on to game two, which is today at 1 o'clock again in Cleveland. 108 first pitch, and it'll be on ESPN. So we'll have lots to talk about tomorrow one way or the other. Will.
Casey Mize on the mound.
Who, I got to be honest, has pitched pretty well this year. Like, he's been okay.
Had a couple of bad outings. 387 ERA. He's 14-6.
Yep. But he's been a plus pitcher for this team.
Well, yeah, let's do it. Come on.
No, you should be hyped now. Scooble did one. Now you take number two and we're done.
That's right. Let's get out of Cleveland. It was something that a lot of people say pretty often.
you said
Cleveland rock.
That's right.
Cleveland
great show,
rock.
By the way.
Yeah.
The Drew Carey Show. Michigan lawmakers approved this stopgap safety measure here to keep the government funded for an extra week.
Okay.
So the deadline was last night at midnight to approve that budget that they had all agreed to. Everybody agreed to it. But now it's just getting things in place, dotting those I's and crossing those T's with all of the legislators in Lansing. And now this will continue for the next week. They're going to get this done.
So services here in the next continue.
Week. Everything goes on as normal. We are not in a shutdown here in the state of Michigan, which is good. They need to pass this.
They basically did what the federal government could not, which is like, let's just pass this, keep operations moving, and then we'll come to a deal after that. And so the state government is open.
And at the federal level, not so much. Federal level, things shut down at midnight, and they did. So we are now in a government shutdown in Washington. And again, you're going to start seeing a lot of these government employees go on furlough. You know, most of the day-to-day in your life probably won't be affected by this too much. But if you want to go to a national park, if you want to go do some of those things, you won't be able to do it because more than likely they're going to be closed down. They're going to start shutting some of these operations down temporarily until they pass this CR is what it seems to be.
But the Democrats are holding tight. You don't want those subsidies, you know, extended for ACA, and they're holding tight because they feel like, listen, this is the only time we can do it. Because if we wait for you guys and we talk about it and we discuss it later on down the line, well, you guys might not want to bring it to the floor because you guys are in charge. So this is our time to do it. So they're holding tight. Let's just see how long they can hold tight without people being affected and calling them and saying, listen, get this done because I'm hurting now.
Or until some of these senators flip their votes and go to a yes vote.
Yeah, that's some new reporting we got from Ryan Schmelz saying that, you know, maybe some of these Democrats who voted no on this CR might be able to be flipped to vote yes. And he also said he talked to Lisa McClain from our state, who says, you know what, maybe we should overhaul or look into this program when it comes to ACA subsidies and Medicare and such, and who gets benefits and who doesn't. But let's not do it right now.
Right.
That wasn't the forward-facing talk, though.
That was not the conversation leading up to last night at midnight. No. Mm-mm.
No.
No. And I think all of those conversations should be had. You should be having those conversations all the time. That is, you know, your job.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think any time that you want to look at, you know, what's expiring, what isn't, do we need to expand? Do we need to, you know, contract some of the things that we're spending? Sure. But all those things need to be talked about all the time. It shouldn't be like, oh, you know what? That's a good idea. Let's do that.
Well, sure, Democrats feel like this is a winning argument because premiums are about to go up, and that really affects people. So that's why they're trying to push this.
Yeah, and Donald Trump loves winning issues, right? Donald Trump talks about taking on issues that are winning issues. He said he doesn't even want to make a decision on daylight savings time because it's a 50-50. Like, some people want it darker earlier. Some people want the daylight to stick around. That's not a winning issue. So take up the winning issue.
Fun fact, and I know this from Andrew Humphrey, the weather guy I work with for like a decade.
Yeah.
Daylight saving, no S. He'd say that all the time when it was coming up. And so it's stuck in my head. Daylight saving, no S. So it's not savings, it's saving. Just a little trivia for you.
Yeah. It's also not Kroger's or Meyer's.
No.
No. Yeah. Singular.
Yeah. We do have an opportunity for you to win $1,000 coming up next here on JR Morning. But first, 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Want to win in business these days? Well, Key Wisdom makes clear that you need to really focus on being online as the priority, right? Well, yes, that is indeed a key tenet for being successful these days, but it's not the whole story. While there is no doubt that consumers are looking for the convenience that the online shopping experience offers today, results from a new Harris poll make clear that consumers want more from brands, especially young shoppers. They want authenticity and multi-sensory experiences that feel personal and memorable, and that can be hard to deliver via the online channel alone. In fact, the Harris survey shows that 79% of consumers say online shopping lacks the magic of an in-person shopping experience. Wait, is the brick-and-mortar shopping experience not yet dead? Indeed, it isn't. Further support shows that consumers still value the in-person physical shopping experience. In addition to the Harris poll data, the Return of Touch report presented by Quad, as reported by eMarketer, underscores that that's the case. Within the in-person shopping experience lies the opportunity for brands to lean into tactile, immersive experiences that drive better recall, deeper loyalty, and ultimately higher ROI. Heidi Wadolski, Vice President and Brand Marketing at Quad, says this: consumers today are looking for experiences that go beyond the transaction. They want to feel something. They want surprise, delight, even belonging. In-person shopping is as much about buying as it is about belonging. Nearly 90% of consumers remember engaging physical store experiences, and 71% say those moments deepened their brand loyalty. For Gen Z and millennials, retail is a social experience. In fact, about 3/4 say shopping at a hyped retailer or pop-up feels like being part of a cultural moment. So what to do? What's the key actionable takeaway from this new data? Well, it's that consumers actually want a blend of the two experiences. Perhaps they want to go in-store to touch and feel and perhaps even try on an item of interest, and yet may actually execute the purchase online or on mobile. Digital and physical integration is the shopping of marketing, especially for Gen Z and other young consumers. So if you're looking for success these days, don't abandon that brick and mortar focus just yet. Focus instead on blending online and offline experiences in a way that delivers both the benefits of convenience of the online experience with the greater loyalty and ROI that only the physical shopping experience can offer. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, and that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, a lot you could do with $1,000, and we've got your chance to win. All you got to do is Texas Hour's national keyword change to 95819. That's change to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text or drive. You can play 5 times each weekday for 5 chances to win. It's 5K a day on 760 WJR. Official rules and more info at WJR.com. Well, Donald Trump rolled out this plan with Benjamin Netanyahu in attendance. What he describes as not only a way to end the war between Hamas and Israel, but a wide-ranging peace plan for the Middle East that would bring a long-lasting peace to the region. There seemed to be some cautious optimism when this plan was rolled out, but what does this really mean for the region, and are all of the major stakeholders really on board? Saeed Khan is the Associate Professor of Teaching and Near Eastern Studies at Wayne State University and rejoins us this morning. Professor, it's good to have you back.
Great to have you back. Thanks, Chris.
What did you make of this plan? You know, Donald Trump said that many of the leaders in the Middle East were on board. They've signed off on this, and now they're just waiting on Hamas to respond. What was your initial thoughts on this 20-point plan?
Well, Chris, whenever they say that things look good on paper, you have to then examine, first of all, do they look good on paper? And second of all, is there something else? Is there fine print? Are there things that we're not really seeing? There are some points here that I think are certainly worthy of commendation. The very idea that President Trump has said that, I mean, officially and formally, that the United States will not allow Israel to annex Gaza and the West Bank seems to be, in baseball terms, a little bit of a brushback against Prime Minister Netanyahu and his coalition of hardliners in the Israeli Knesset. So that would certainly be seen as a very good development. But there are a lot of issues, I think, that we have to really also tweeze apart. This whole idea about commitment, who really is on board. As you said, there are a lot of regional parties that are on board, but the Palestinians, even beyond Hamas, have not really been consulted about this. I thought it was quite interesting that here was the Israeli prime minister, one party to the conflict, and the American president giving this joint press conference, but there were no Arab leaders, or certainly not even a Palestinian representative. If you recall, the U.S. blocked even the Palestinian Authority officials to travel to the United States for the U.N. General Assembly meeting the previous week. So there's a lot of imbalance here. We don't know if the stakeholders are going along with this as a way to kind of throw it back to Netanyahu to say, okay, the ball's in your court, you're running out of excuses, you need to make some concessions. We still are a long ways away from being able to have a victory lap over this.
Professor, the plan requires Hamas to lay down its arms, and something it has rejected in the past. And if that condition is non-negotiable, I mean, is this peace plan already set up to fail?
Again, Lloyd, I think that we're asking perhaps incomplete questions. Demilitarized Hamas also means that there's no defense of any kind, and particularly when we've seen not only since October the 7th, 2023, but a consistent pattern of Israeli incursions into the Gaza, and now we see even into the West Bank, it would be very unlikely to see that Hamas would completely demilitarize, particularly when there is no real teeth in this agreement for Israel to reduce its military posture or its securitization of the region.
Does this seem like a viable option that might get us over the finish line of trying to end this war? It seems like the closest.
Well, closeness, Jamie, means that, I mean, if I'm flying over the Atlantic and I'm over Iceland, I guess I'm closer than if I was over Ireland. It doesn't mean that it's much closer, in part because we also have to use the analogy further, see if there's enough fuel in the tank and if people really have the will to land the plane. Mm-hmm. In the case of this plan, we don't really have what has always been sought, and that is a two-state solution where there's a Palestinian state as well. And it's important to remember that this is really coming on the heels of an unprecedented increase in the number of countries that now recognize a Palestinian state. So we saw at the United Nations General Assembly last week mm-hmm. that it was American allies and Israeli allies, including Australia, Portugal, France, the United Kingdom, and Canada, all recognizing a Palestinian state. And so for the United States to now still, along with Israel and just a few other countries, still be in denial of the world opinion and the international recognition of a Palestinian state makes anything less than that, even, for example, this agreement, not saying it, problematic to say the least.
What do you make of this board that was then also pitched, this idea that Donald Trump would lead it, Tony Blair would be on board as well, and they would provide some sort of oversight. Is that an effective method here to carry out this plan?
Well, Chris, the reason I'm chuckling a little bit is that as a historian of the Middle East, I know that part of the reason we're in the quagmire we are is because of plans like this. Gaza, all of Palestine and Israel and other areas that now we recognize as countries in the region, including Iraq and Jordan, Lebanon and Syria. In fact, I was just teaching this on Monday in one of my classes. We're all part of the British and the French mandates. It was the Europeans who came in, carved up a territory that was once part of the Ottoman Empire, installed leaders there for their own interest, not for the interest of the region. And when it suited them, they kicked the can further down the road before granting independence of these people. Tony Blair is just going to be seen as yet another British mandate power. And particularly for the Arabs, that doesn't instill a whole lot of confidence because the mandate in Palestine was heavily skewed in one direction when it came to whom they preferred on the ground. Blair also has hanging over him charges of being a war criminal in his complicity with the Iraq war in 2003. And then also what's even more troubling is, and the Israeli newspapers have been divulging this, there is the plan for, as this is called, the Board of Peace. This is really Orwellian terms. It's actually going to be, as you see in provision number 10, an economic development plan. And so what we've got basically is a bunch of business people who are going to be sitting here and looking as to how to develop Gaza. It's not just the Riviera of the Middle East or the Mediterranean that they're planning on putting here. It's also important to remember that there are billions of metric tons of natural gas right off the coast of Gaza. And so there's a lot of suspicion that this is turning Gaza into basically a corporate zone. And we've seen this in the Middle East before when it comes to oil with Iran in the 1950s. There's really not a whole lot of openness and transparency as to what is intended when it comes to this so-called peace plan. Mm.
Something that we're going to continue to watch, and we'll see what the decisions of Hamas are. Word was that they're going to be meeting with some Qatari officials today. So perhaps later on today, we'll get their perspective on where they're at with this deal. Professor Saeed Khan, thank you so much for your insight, as always. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, you got it. Coming up next, we've seen an uptick in violence against churches. We'll talk about that on the other side on JR Morning.
Grand Blanc community still reeling from that attack on the church where 4 members died, 8 others were wounded. And, you know, the Free Press got an interview with the father. His name is Thomas Sanford. He apologized to the families of the people killed. Quote, "I feel terrible about all the families have been hurt. They're under the same crap that I'm going under, that my wife and I are going under. I apologize for that." So that's the latest with that up in Grand Blanc. And it got me to thinking about all these attacks, you know. I mean, the Tree of Life Synagogue attack hit me deeply because it was in Pittsburgh and 11 people died there. Mm-hmm. That's my hometown. And then those 2 little children killed in church recently. And just like all of these attacks, and we heard from the administration that there's an uptick. Is that true? What does Nathan Berkley, Associate Vice President, U.S. Strategies and Communications at the Religious Freedom Institute, have to say about all this? Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
I think you're going to say that that is indeed correct. According to FBI crime reports, it's up 100% between 2021 and 2023, attacks on churches, mosques, temples, synagogues.
That's right. And in fact, even if you just look in the last month, Annunciation Catholic Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota was attacked. 18 kids were shot. A number of people died. 2 more children died. And even in Wayne, Michigan, there was a shooter who walked into a church back in June, and a security officer confronted and shot and killed him before he was able to harm others. So there has been a number of shootings even the last couple of months on this in this way. But I will say, if you widen the lens just a little bit to include arson and bomb threats, vandalism, assaults on individuals that don't involve shootings, there has been an uptick in the last few years. To such an extent that even the Catholic bishops in the United States have tracked this since 2020, and there have been more than 370 attacks of that these kinds on Catholic churches around the country. Another organization has tracked this, Family Research Council in D.C., and they found that acts of hostility against U.S. churches has amounted to about 1,300 since 2018. So there has been an uptick.
Why is that? Why have we seen this uptick?
Well, it is difficult to get at all the factors involved. But one thing we can say, I mean, you can look at individual motives like we have in with the individual and grand blanks. There can be very personal motives. There can be mental health issues involved. But there is certainly something in our cultural ethos that is causing people who have a range of dispositions and ideas about religious communities that's causing them to take that rage and direct it in this particularly violent way. And that is something that we all need to come to grips with. Even broadening a bit more, ideologically fueled violence is something that in U.S. history has ebbed and flowed. And it appears we may be entering into a period where that kind of violence intended to convey a message about something, is something that we're going to have to deal with and try to mitigate in any way that we can.
So do you see this violence as being motivated more by ideology or mental health crisis or something else?
Well, I think it is a combination. We have to look at individual cases. I understand that the state lawmakers who were shot in their homes in Minnesota were targeted by an individual who understood that he was being directed by, you know, Governor Waltz to commit those terrible acts. But then there are other cases where it seems, even though there's clearly something wrong with these individuals who go into houses of worship of all places and commit these acts of violence, where they are aware of what they're doing, and they are intending to express some kind of discontent or rage or animus toward those religious bodies, as we have with the individual in Grand Blanc. Although even there, we have a circumstance where the individual had a relationship, I understand, with someone who was within the LDS community. And so there might have been a number of personal and ideological reasons that motivated him to do this terrible, terrible thing.
We're hearing a lot of messaging that the attacks on Christians and Christianity is the worst. Is it really just against one religion or faith or people?
Well, I do think that in particular, Christian churches in the United States have been targeted, again, not only with violence, but acts of vandalism, as I said earlier, arson in particular. Yeah, there have been I guess those actions have been directed against Christian churches. That's just true. Now, as you mentioned, we have the circumstance a number of years ago in Pittsburgh. There have been violent acts committed, since 9/11 against mosques. So the incidents of this sort have broadly affected religious communities in the United States. In the last few years, it certainly seems to be that it's targeting Christians more than others. Now, Christian churches are also more prevalent in the United States, so that certainly plays into it. But Christians in particular, perhaps related to moral convictions that Christians hold that are increasingly out of step with many that are advancing culture, I think that certainly is part of it. But that's only part of the explanation.
Well, you go back to the early 90s where you had about 90% of the American public identifying as Christian, somewhere under that umbrella. Now that's down to about 60%, at least that was in a couple of years ago. And then the New York Times just came out with a story back in February that said the decline of Christianity has just stopped. So earlier this year, it kind of flatlined. Does the movement away from religion, does that have something to play into this as well?
Well, it certainly may. And in fact, that flatlining, I think there's evidence of that even in Western Europe as well, where the bottom has really fallen out on Christian faith and practice. So, as society has become more secular, people speculate that has, kind of increased the animus toward those who remain faithful Christians in the United States. I think that's possible, although the reality is there are many kind of expressions of secularism that are starting to look a lot more religious. So as people are, moving away from the Christian faith, they tend to be embracing, other kind of modes of spirituality. So how to think about why that would lead in particular to animus toward Christians, is hard to determine, but we can certainly, if we can't fully explain it, we can describe it. It does indeed seem to be happening.
And for people who are listening who still feel shaken about this grand blank shooting, what would you say about the importance of just continuing to gather in community despite these threats?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the deepest exercises of religion, in America or anywhere in the world, is gathering for worship. I mean, these are places intended to be ones of solemnity and awe and joy, and they are critical in the life of faith for Christians and for others as well. And it is imperative that people continue to gather, although it's important also for religious leaders of congregations to take seriously some basic security protocols for being aware of surroundings and looking for signs of danger and that sort of thing. Now, these lone wolf shooters tragically don't leave a lot of options available for absolutely detecting them in advance, and that's just true. But religious communities must continue to gather. People of faith must continue to gather with people of like mind. If you believe that, for instance, if you're a Christian, you believe Christianity is true, then you must gather for worship. It's an integral part of the life of faith, and I certainly encourage everyone who is in a faith community to continue to do that, even while their leaders take very seriously the kind of vigilance that they must have, especially during these times.
And we are going to talk about the safety of local churches coming up at 8:19. Nathan Berkley of the Religious Freedom Institute, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you for covering this the way you have.
Coming up on JR Morning, both sides pushing blame on this federal government shutdown. We'll talk to Debbie Dingell about what's happening behind closed doors. That's at 7:49. But now I'm going to talk about Shelby Mechanical. It's fall, and there could be some common plumbing issues related to this change of season. You could have clogged drains, sump pump failure. Soonish, we're going to be having problems with frozen pipes, and you should call Shelby Mechanical. I use Shelby Mechanical. I've used them for a couple jobs now, and their staff is amazing. They listen, they act fast, and we have no problems moving forward. This fall, make sure to take advantage of the Shelby Mechanical plumbing discounts. $35 off garbage disposal replacement, $100 off water heater install, and $50 off snake and camera service. Take advantage of these fall discounts. To get same day or next day plumbing service, call Shelby Mechanical for your home or office, 586-726-9444, or visit shelbymechanical.net. That's shelbymechanical.net. For projects big and small, you know who to call. Shelby Mechanical for all your plumbing needs.
Well, it's Wednesday. It's time for today's Capitol Report, sponsored by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And we know up in Lansing, there is a deal to avoid a shutdown. It is going to go at least another week before they can vote on that and make sure things are in order. But in the meantime, services will continue here in the state of Michigan. But I can't say that for the federal government, who has officially shut down for the first time in nearly 7 years. A divided Washington remains deadlocked over a funding deal, leaving over 750,000 federal employees either furloughed or working without pay. And the blame game is intensifying, with Republicans insisting on a clean 7-week extension and Democrats refusing to fund the government without major concessions on health care, specifically enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. Joining us on the JR Morning Live line is Democratic Congressman Debbie Dingell, representing Michigan's 6th Congressional District. Congresswoman, good morning.
Good morning, my friends. How are you?
I am. We are doing well.
How are you?
Yeah.
I'm tired, to be honest.
Well, yeah, I can understand that. So the Senate failed to pass both the Democratic and GOP proposals to avert this shutdown. And as a member of the Democratic caucus, what's the fundamental non-negotiable sticking point right now? Is it the Affordable Care Act subsidies, the Medicaid cuts, or is it just the political fight itself?
This is the point that we're at. We've already passed a bill this year that is hurting people across the country in our state. We have hospitals that are already on the verge of closing. Many people worried about what's going to happen. But right now, October 1st, many of the insurance companies are mailing out their premiums for the year and telling people what they're going to be. The Affordable Care Act exchange opens on November 1, and the tax credits expire at the end of December. It's now. It's here. We have to get this resolved. And if we don't, we all, so many people, we hear it. You know it for a variety of reasons. I'm not going to trash tariffs or do anything like that. But everybody's got increased grocery costs, housing, just the cost of everything. Utility bills are going up. I'm going to give you the example I use, and I could give you 10 more, is a couple in my district. They're both 60, combined income, $82,000. If the Affordable Care Act tax credit isn't extended, their insurance is going up by $11,250, a 164% increase. Part of it's at their age and where they're living, but they can't afford that. They're going to have to go without health insurance. And we all pay a price when that happens. And the problem is, you know, if you say, well, we can talk about it, we don't have any guardrails in our budget right now. The budget that we have passed earlier this year has had pocket rescissions and executive orders. So that money we appropriated, the president signed, hasn't been spent on things as simple, I think they're simple, as school lunches, as law enforcement. So if we don't have guardrails that the money that we do appropriate is going to get spent, it's just at some point you got to take a stand. And if it's fighting for my constituents on being able for them to have health care and afford their medicine, then that's where we are.
So Congresswoman, isn't that more of a legislative issue? Isn't that something that you would deal with on the back end? I mean, John Thune's talked about having this conversation after a CR is passed. Lisa McClain has signaled that that's something that she's willing and wanting to talk about. Why would we hold this up now? Not you, not even the party, just in general. Why would we hold this up now and go to a shutdown when that's something that might be able to be addressed after this is signed?
Because the moment's here. The money for it is in this continuing resolution. Without it or not there, and we don't have guardrails. And
guardrails meaning what? What do you mean?
I mean that the president has to spend the money that we appropriate.
Okay.
I mean, that's just exactly where we are now. You have seen time and time again, many of the programs have impacted things that you care about. By the way, we should have been negotiating this. We should have been discussing this. Mm-hmm. The president refused to meet, has not met with Schumer, who's the head of the Democratic leader of the Senate, Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader of the House, canceled his meeting last Thursday, and I think finally realized how bad it looked, with him for the very first time since he's been president on Monday. Mm-hmm. That's not sitting at a table. I don't think compromise is a dirty word. I think we should be getting bipartisan agreements and sitting down, but not meeting with Democrats, not sitting at a table, isn't negotiation.
Respond to this talking point of, well, Democrats just want health care for illegal aliens. Could you give us facts about that?
I hope you ask me that question. Facts. Illegal aliens are not eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. And I'm very happily going to send you all a copy of the bill, just like I'm going to do another one. And he was nice about it, too. But it's an outright lie. It is not the case. And those two people in my district that make $82,000 and 60 years old are union workers that have worked in, but were former union workers and have lived in this country all their lives. They're not even second generation. So, what they're trying to do is to play to something that's like putting your red flag in front of a ball. And it has been illegal. Illegal aliens cannot get Medicaid, period.
And Congresswoman, given the threat of a shutdown, seems to be this recurring weapon and these budget fights. What's the long-term legislative solution Congress needs to enact to maybe remove the government shutdown as a negotiating tool?
Well, I think we need to look at it. I don't have any answers. I haven't been seasoned and have watched more incidents of this outside the government than inside the government. But sometimes it's become much more divided in the last two decades, as we all know. And I think democracy means that everybody can have different opinions, should have different opinions. Democracy is the strongest when you bring different life perspectives, different experiences, and make sure that everybody has a voice at the table and you listen to each other. But we've become more and more divided until you get showdowns like this. And in the end, I'm going to say to you, it's the American people that when the elections have consequences and you need to be telling your elected representative what you expect of them. And as elected representatives, we need to be listening to the people that elect us.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, always love hearing you here on JR Morning. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, everybody. Be safe.
You as well. And coming up on JR Morning, we'll talk more about those Tigers who really...
Yay! Go get them, Detroit Tigers!
That was Chris singing that, please. Not me this time. And we'll also tell you about the CEO that was charged in the Troy hyperbaric chamber death. She was sent to jail yesterday. Tell you why coming up.
All right, 8 o'clock hour. Still a lot to do. We've got Name That Tune today as well, so you can play along. I was so thrilled. It was a complete pick-me-up yesterday when the Tigers won.
Oh, my God. Yes.
I mean, I was like, you know, I'm sitting there. I felt like an old man. I'm, like, dozing off a little bit. Yeah, I'm just like, you know, and then it was just like, boom, that adrenaline, the excitement. It was such a big win for this team, not only because it's a postseason win.
Yeah.
It's a three-game series, so that win is absolutely huge. Scooble, the whole deal. But against the Guardians, on the road, a team that they just, for whatever reason, have a real difficult time with, you know, to get that win was huge.
Tarek Skubal was unbelievable. I mean, I thought he was going to go the distance. He had it, and he almost did. He made it 7 2/3 innings, 14K. The Tigers' bats are concerning, but, hey, they got it done with some small ball, and they won 2-1, but they're going to win the series now. That's my point of view.
I agree. And Skubal, I mean, you know, he's a great pitcher, but he was throwing with purpose yesterday. I mean, just the way he was throwing the ball, it was just amazing.
Jason, do you have any words of wisdom for us here? Yesterday you said the score, you know, you could see it being 2-1, a Tigers loss. It was 2-1, a Tigers win. Do you have any? Any other way you want to besmirch our team?
What I should have said is I could see it going 2-1 either way.
Okay. Pull the tape.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Sure. You can say that now.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's, you know what? These pesky Guardians, let's just take care of them today. Get rid of them.
It's going to happen.
You know what?
19-0. Here we go. Let's move on.
That's a little far-fetched, but okay.
Casey Mize will make his postseason debut for the Tigers. Hopefully some of that Skubal magic rubbed off on Casey Mize. Skubal, his line is 7 2/3, 107 pitches, 14 strikeouts. I mean, he was unbelievable, and here he is postgame.
Yeah, it means a lot. It means a lot to take the ball game on. To have the trust of our whole organization, teammates, coaches, you know, coaching staff, it means a lot. And it doesn't really matter how we got here. You know, we got in, everybody's in the same boat, and we're up 1-0 in a best of three. So it doesn't really matter how you get here, as long as you get in.
It's a much better place to be up 1-0 than down 1-0.
Like I was telling you before the show, Chris, 96 pitches after 7 innings. Please put him back in there. Please give him one more inning.
Yeah.
Because the bullpen has been so shaky, and he ended up getting two more hitters. So
Will Vest, though, looked pretty good yesterday.
He did.
You know, I thought, for the most part, whatever struggles that he may have had a couple of weeks ago, seems like his last couple outings have been pretty good. So they go again today down in Cleveland, 1 o'clock pitch, 108 pitch, I think it is, on ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's go.
Let's get it done.
Let's do it.
Let's go, Casey. Come on.
The state government was up against it. They had a midnight deadline until the government shut down, but they passed their own version of a continuing resolution for a week. And the government continues to operate here in the state of Michigan. Nothing's closed. It is business as usual. And then they're just taking these extra couple of days to to sort out all the details, make sure everybody's on the same page, make sure they've got
the T's.
Yeah, make sure they've got everybody, all their caucuses on the same page. So that's good news.
That's good news. They finally passed, you know, this continuing situation around 2 a.m. They're supposed to come back on October 1st, which is today, and do some work to finalize this 2026 state budget. There's this Article 9, Section 17 of the Michigan Constitution that no money can go out unless the budget bill is passed, but they figured out a way to make this work so no services are interrupted. And the lawmakers are saying, okay, this is a win. We found a way to compromise to keep the conversation going.
Well, how come we couldn't do that in the federal?
Well,
you know,
yeah. The majority floor leader, Brian Posthumous of Rockford, said that they probably won't vote until Thursday. So tomorrow.
But they have the leeway. Time.
Correct. Yeah. He said a budget's done. It's agreed upon.
It's done.
It's the process now that they're going through. A couple days to draft it, and then they're gonna vote, and it should pass. So that's good news. But you're right. At the federal level, we're in a shutdown. First time since 2018. Just the 21st time since 1977. And you know, we may be in a situation where you get a couple more votes today. Or the next time they vote.
May flip some Democrats.
We're not totally sure. Yeah, maybe some Democrats in the Senate flip to support the continuing resolution. And then whatever the issues are that the Democrats have raised, and insurance being, I think, a valid one for all Americans, then have that conversation. I don't think that we need to shy away from that. I don't think that it needs to be a contentious point. I think we need to have the conversations. At the very minimum, have the conversations. Mm-hmm.
I don't think shutting down the government is a winning cause for anybody. You got people who need to pay daycare and rent and everything else, and they're just supposed to show up to work and not get paid. I don't think it works.
No. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell tells us we're in our divided government era.
It's become much more divided in the last two decades, as we all know. And I think democracy means that everybody can have different opinions, should have different opinions. Democracy is the strongest when you bring different life perspectives, different experiences, and make sure that everybody has a voice at the table and you listen to each other. But we've become more and more divided until you get showdowns like this. And in the end, I'm going to say to you, it's the American people that when the elections have consequences and you need to be telling your elected representative what you expect of them.
Yeah, okay. I mean, that's always the case. Call your congressional or your representative or your senator and tell them what you think.
The CEO of an Oakland County healthcare facility already facing charges in the death of a 5-year-old boy killed in that hyperbaric chamber explosion has been sent to jail for violating her bond. Prosecutors say 58-year-old Tamela Peterson of Brighton failed to surrender a firearm as required after posting a $2 million bond. Instead, she admitted keeping the gun with her husband before it was sold. Judge Maureen McGinnis called the violation especially troubling, saying it should have been the easiest condition to follow. Peterson pleaded guilty to the violation and was ordered to serve 2 days in jail before returning to home confinement. She and three employees are charged with in connection with the January explosion at the Oxford Center that killed young Thomas Cooper and injured his mother. A request to modify her bond was denied.
Terrible story.
It really is.
It's horrible, and, you know, one of your bond, part of your bond is, you know, to get rid of, you know, to turn your gun in, and you just keep it and sell it and say, oh, this is okay, I got rid of it. But that's not what the judge said.
Yeah, it really is a terrible story. It continues to be one.
Go ahead.
And one with long-reaching ramifications.
Sure. Yes.
Horrible story. Let's play the message from our Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth. He used some letters.
Should our enemies choose foolishly to challenge us, they will be crushed by the violence, precision, and ferocity of the War Department. In other words, to our enemies, F-A-F-O.
And for FCC purposes.
Looking right into the camera.
Yeah.
Well, we could just say F around and find out.
Bleep around and find out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He paused for applause. If you've seen the video now,
yes,
it's a little cringy.
I mean, you're in a room full of like generals and admirals.
I mean, come on,
it's definitely
they
not going to be.
Yes. They should be apolitical. That's what they should have done.
That's
but
right.
He paused for applause.
Yeah, I don't know why that meeting needed to happen necessarily. I get it. You want to make the leanest, meanest fighting machine possible to deter wars and to fight wars if necessary. I don't know really the benefit of having all of those generals and admirals in that room in Quantico.
I just think that maybe he feels like if you go and you go to different places and talk to each one of them or whatever, that somebody's going to hear something different from what the other person said. So you get them all together, you all hear the same thing, and you make your decision there.
Whether it's Grand Blanc, whether it's Pittsburgh, whether it's Minnesota, there's been an uptick in targeted attacks against places of worship. What are some leaders doing to prevent an attack like that from happening? We'll talk about it next on JR Morning.
And this past Sunday, tragic shooting and fire at the church in Grand Blanc has left a lot of communities shaken and raised urgent questions about how to keep houses of worship safe, guys. And, you know, you're hearing more and more of these events happening in places of faith. And churches are now beginning to have security in the church, people with firearms in the church. It was not like that not so long ago, but now you're having more of it. And on the phone to talk more about this is Ralph Gottbee. He is the former Detroit police chief, and he is now chief of staff at Triumph Church. And he was just down the street when the attack happened at the church in Grand Blanc. Chief, good morning.
Good morning, Lloyd. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you for joining us this morning. Kind of take us to that moment when you noticed something strange was happening just down the street from where you were. Why were you in that area in the first place?
Well, as you know, Triumph Church is a multi-campus church, and we have two facilities, one in Burton, Michigan, and one in Flint. On the way to the Flint campus for our Sunday morning service, and as I was on the way, I-75 approaching the Grand Blanc area, the police and public safety activity, it was so, so voluminous. And just from my experience of almost 30 years of law enforcement, I knew something really bad was going on. I had no idea until I got to the church. And some of the staff informed me that there was a mass shooting at the Church of Latter-day Saints in Grand Blanc. In the immediacy of the moment, we did not know that the shooter was put down. And, to the first responders, the two police officers from different agencies that responded, Lloyd, they did it by the numbers. They approached the threat. They eliminated the threat. But the carnage and what was left over in the aftermath, I think the average mass shooting, most of it happens within 5 to 10 minutes. And just to know how devastating and devastated that community is, what it's done across the country, it is just absolutely heartbreaking to know what Grand Blanc is going through.
As you said, they got there within 30 seconds, and then this still happened. Does that make people of faith, people who gather to practice their faith, on edge? And how can we keep these churches, synagogues, mosques safe?
It absolutely does. And you bring up an excellent point, because a church, a mosque, a temple, that's the place that people go for refuge and redemption. It's supposed to be a welcoming environment. But unfortunately, in these times, even churches, which are considered soft targets because of that, we have to have levels of security, whether it's visible or, somewhat discreet. We also have to have people that are trained to recognize certain things. And then also and when I mean certain things, I mean from a mental health standpoint, there are some manic behaviors that if you are trained properly, that will give you some cues. And then last but not least, we also have to have active shooter protocols so that people that, if the police don't get there as fast, or if you're encountering it immediately, sound off, cover, evacuate, fight. If you're in a position to where you could possibly disarm or disrupt the shooter, there are just a number of training protocols that churches are going to have to engage in. It's just a sign of the times that we're in.
Mike Harville is the president of the Security Leaders Coalition. He told Channel 7 that more churches are taking this seriously. They're ramping up security measures to protect their congregations. What do you do at Triumph to make sure that that your congregations are safe?
Well, we train quarterly. We have monthly leadership meetings, and those are the topics that we go over. We do have a security staff. They're volunteer, most of which are professional security experts and or law enforcement, some retired law enforcement. I'm retired law enforcement, so we're very fortunate in our congregation to have, you know, we have three former chiefs of police that are members of Triumph Church, former state director of the Michigan State Police. So we have a lot of expertise and training that's involved in our volunteer security. It's very discreet, but it is visible, and we do understand that, you know, there are unfortunately people that, you know, they get radicalized to a certain way of thinking. And when people get to a point of religiosity to where they now demonize somebody for their belief, it is just a horrible combination. And then you add to that just the vitriolic nature of the, you know, public discourse from a political standpoint. And that's, I'm not commentating left or right. Vitriol is vitriol. Hate is hate.
Yeah.
And, you know, when that's out there, all it takes is one individual that's disturbed. And this is the thing, team. Security has to be right 100% of the time. An assailant only has to get it right once to devastate a community. So that's what we're up against. And then you add to that, mental health helps. Thank God they are becoming much more okay to talk about. We still have a long way to go to make sure that we normalize mental health and wellness.
Ralph Godbey, the former Detroit police chief, now chief of staff at Triumph Church. Appreciate you coming on and giving us some insight this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity, and prayers continue to go out for the Dempsey County area.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You know, and it's getting to the point where, you know, these, you're asking, do we need metal detectors? Do we need security guards? How much security is too much when you have a place of worship where people are welcome?
Yeah, whatever people feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Coming up, those Tigers, we will talk about that game yesterday. It was awesome with the MLB Network reporter coming up at 8:35.
We talked to John Paul Morosi of the MLB Network. When was that?
It was last week.
Was it this week or last week?
Last week.
Either way,
week.
It was before the postseason. And we were wondering what in the heck this Tigers team was going to do. Boom, they come out with a win. Tarek Skubal gets the Tigers a win. And now I'm thinking they can win this series. John Paul Morosi, what do you think?
Well, Jamie, good morning, and good morning, Chris and Lloyd as well. They're in a good position now, and it's not just that they won yesterday with Skubal on the mound, and I'm sure we'll get more into that 14-strikeout masterpiece, but the fact that only Will Vest was needed out of the bullpen was a really important detail, because now the bullpen is rested, ready, one would assume rather confident after what happened yesterday and seeing their teammate go out there and pitch so well. And then Will Vest's amazing escape in the ninth inning, which, to be honest, I did not think he was going to be able to achieve. And so now you've got the pen rested. You've got one game to win among the next two. Certainly the Tigers hoping to wrap it up today. But that was about as good of a script as you could imagine. Imagine this side of maybe not quite getting the bats going in the way that you wanted, but a win is a win, especially in the postseason.
Casey Mize on the mound for this afternoon. How do you see him matching up with Cleveland's Tanner Beebe?
Well, I think in general, Mize has earned this start. He was a clear choice, in my view, to start game two. He's been the Tigers' second-best pitcher. Certainly, he's not at the level of Skubal, but he was an all-star this year for a reason. He was a former number one overall pick for a reason. And he spoke yesterday about how meaningful it is for him to be in this situation because, of course, last year in the division series, he was left off the roster entirely. He was not even a starting pitcher that the Tigers were trusting in a big spot. So it's a different year, a new year. I think his secondary stuff has improved. He's really worked closely with Chris Fetter and Robin Lund, the pitching coaches, to find some different ways to attack hitters. And I think we've seen it in his results over the course of the season. I thought it was interesting. Skubal said yesterday after the game that the way that Mize pitched on Friday in Boston was the best he had ever seen Mize pitch. Mm. Now, the Red Sox lineup top to bottom, in my view, is better than Cleveland's lineup. Mm-hmm. And so Mize's most recent outing was a really good outing against a better team than what he's going to face this afternoon in Cleveland. That's a really good sign for the Detroit Tigers. I like Mize's chances. He's not someone that typically goes into the eighth inning, let's say, so the bullpen will be involved again today and probably for more innings and more outs than what they had to do yesterday in relief of Skubal. But in general, I do like the Tigers' chances, and I think that we're seeing continued confidence. Yes, there could have been better situational hitting, but how about two sacrifice bunts yesterday? Mm-hmm. One of them a squeeze play,
right,
for a team that had five the entire season. So they're showing the ability to be adaptable, and yesterday it won them a ball game in one of the biggest settings that you could imagine.
I do want to go back to Skubal's outing, though. I mean, 14 strikes. He was absolutely working every pitch in his arsenal. What makes him so difficult to hit? I mean, he's one of the more effortless players to touch 99 on the gun that I've seen in a while.
He's just one of the very best pitchers in the world right now, maybe the best. And you consider his repertoire, and if you go back to when the Tigers made the World Series in 06, that was back in an era in the game when even good fastballs would be 90 miles an hour. 90 miles an hour is Tarek Skubal's changeup.
Right.
That's the change of pace from the fastball that he throws at 101. And he was able to reach 101 and 100 miles an hour multiple times in the seventh inning. It's like the Barry Sanders of pitching right now. I mean, he is the best to do it right now in the major leagues. And it's important for all fans to appreciate just how great he is at his craft. I mean, you're seeing the very best at it. And I think that the fastball is not just 101, it's 101 with movement. He's got a really good slider that Dylan Dingler was calling a lot yesterday that is just darting out of the zone and just giving hitters no chance. And that was even Stephen Vogt on the other side, that the Cleveland's manager, saying when Skubal is pitching like that, you're probably not going to have a lot of success. And when you think about the way that they scored their run, it was on the benefit of basically two hits in a walk, and it was two infield hits. The ball didn't even leave the infield, and that was how the Guardians got their one run. So it's almost like when teams are scoring runs against Skubal now, it's because of an accident. It's because of a glitch in the matrix, and that was the case yesterday, just the one run, and he was utterly dominant outside of that.
John Paul, I said yesterday before the game that most of the pressure is going to be on the Guardians. Now, with that loss to the Tigers, I'm looking at their faces after the game. They really look like they were pressurized. I mean, do you think that, you know, mentally that they're, you know, they're kind of out of it?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think that they're out of it by any stretch. I think that there's certainly a reasonable universe in which the Guardians win the next two games and win the series. But what I'll say is this. Baseball is a very difficult sport to play, winning every single game or darn close to it for weeks and weeks and weeks at a time. And the Guardians did that to be able to win the division. It people want to focus, and they should. Obviously, the Tigers did not play very good baseball in September. But meanwhile, the Guardians were playing historically great. And there were two sides to that story. The point I'm making here is that the way the Guardians were playing was not terribly sustainable, especially for a lineup that outside of Ramirez and Kwan and Manzardo, they don't really have a lot of name-brand offensive players. They're not going to win games 10-2 on a consistent basis. And so this, and I always hate to make arguments just based on, well, things in the universe sort of leveling back out and regressing to the mean. But that's, you know, on some level what you're probably going to see. The Guardians, I think their big triumph was just getting into the postseason, being able to win the division improbably as the Tigers were spiraling. And the Tigers were not as bad as they looked late, and the Guardians were probably not as great as they looked late in the regular season. And I think yesterday was the Tigers being due to win a very close game in Cleveland. They finally did it. And now I think that the Tigers have had multiple looks at Bivey recently. He's a really good pitcher. But I think when the Tigers lineup is really clicking, and they were close yesterday, there was a couple moments, and yes, they need to strike out less often, but they're a lineup that I think is bound to have some good at-bats. I thought early on yesterday, Torkelson set the tone with that clutch hit in the first inning. You can win playoff games 2-1. The Tigers did it yesterday. And if they can find a way to just scratch out a couple runs early against someone who I think is not quite as impressive of a pitcher as who the Tigers faced in game one, I like the Tigers' chances. I think there's a lot to be pretty encouraged about. And then, of course, they make that long flight out to Seattle and take their chances against a really good team in Seattle there in game one on Saturday.
Well, I like what you're saying there. I don't want to jinx anything right here, but you're talking Seattle already. I appreciate it. Thank you, John Paul Morosi.
Jamie, thank you so much for the conversation. Enjoy game two this afternoon.
We certainly will. Go Tigers.
Go Tigers.
Let's go.